as it was sucked through the hole. Within a few seconds, it had disappeared completely, compressed to a billionth of its size, and catapulted to elsewhere. The sergeant pushed his cap to the back of his head and sighed. There was nothing he could do. I repeated my question. How many? Oh, the truck is gone, an entire mobile library, 12 cars and a motorcycle. Maybe 20 people. That's a lot of matter, I said grimly. The distortion could grow to the size of a football field by the time the Chrono Guard gets here. The sergeant shrugged. He had never been briefed on what to do with temporal instabilities. I turned to Bowden. Come on. What? We've a little job to do. You're crazy. Perhaps. Can't we wait for the Chrono Guard? They'd never get here in time. It's easy. A lobotomized monkey could do it. And where are we going to find a lobotomized monkey at this time of night? You're being windy, Bowden. True. Do you know what will happen if we fail? We won't. It's a doddle. Dad was in the Chrono Guard. He told me all about this sort of thing. The secret is in the spheres. In 4 hours we could be seeing a major global disaster occurring right in front of our eyes. A rent in time so large we won't know for sure that the here and now isn't the there and then. The rout of civilization, panic in the streets, the end of the world as we know it. Hey, kid! I had seen a young lad bouncing a basketball on the road. The boy reluctantly gave it to me, and I returned to Bowden, who was waiting uneasily by the car. We put the hood down, and Bowden sat in the passenger seat, clutching the basketball grimly. A basketball? It's a sphere, isn't it? I replied, remembering Dad's advice all those years ago. Are you ready? Ready, replied Bowden in a slightly shaky voice. I started the car and rolled slowly up to where the traffic police stood in shocked amazement. Are you sure you know what you're doing? Asked the young officer. Sort of, I replied, truthfully enough. Does anyone have a watch with a second hand? The youngest traffic cop took his watch off and handed it over. I noted the real time, 5:30 a.m., and then reset the hands to 12 o'clock. I strapped the watch onto the rearview mirror. The sergeant wished us good luck as we drove off, yet his thoughts were more along the lines of sooner you than me. Around us, the sky was lightening into dawn, yet the area around the vehicles was still night. Time for the trapped cars had stood still, but only to observers from the outside. To the occupants, everything was happening as normal, except that if they looked behind them, they would witness the dawn breaking rapidly. The first 50 yards seemed plain enough to Bowden and me, but as we drove closer, the car and bike seemed to speed up, and by the time we had drawn level with the green car, we were both moving at about 60 miles per hour. I glanced at the watch on the rearview mirror and noted that precisely 3 minutes had elapsed. Bowden had been watching what was going on behind us. As he and I drove towards the instability, the officer's movements seemed to accelerate until they were just a blur. The cars that had been blocking the carriageway were turned round and directed swiftly back down the hard shoulder at a furious rate. Bowden also noticed the sun rising rapidly behind us and wondered quite what he had let himself in for. The green saloon had two occupants, a man and a woman. The woman was asleep, and the driver was looking at the dark hole that had opened up in front of them. I shouted to him to stop. He wound down his window, and I repeated myself, added, "Spec Ops," and waved my ID. He dutifully applied his brakes, and his stoplights came on, puncturing the darkness. 3 minutes and 26 seconds had elapsed since we had begun our journey. From where the Chrono Guard was standing, they could just see the brake lights on the green saloon come languidly on in the funnel of darkness that was the event's influence. They watched the progress of the green saloon over the next 10 minutes as it made an almost imperceptible turn towards the hard shoulder. It was nearly 10 a.m. and an advanced Chrono Guard outfit had arrived direct from Wareham. Their equipment and operatives were being airlifted in an SO-12 Chinook helicopter, and Colonel Rutter had flown ahead to see what needed to be done. He had been surprised that two ordinary officers had volunteered for this hazardous duty, especially as nobody could tell him who we were. Even a check of my car registration didn't help, as it was still listed as belonging to the garage I had bought it from. The only positive thing about the whole damn mess, he noted, was the fact that the passenger seemed to be holding a sphere of some sort. If the hole grew any bigger and time slowed down even more, It might take them several months to reach us, even in the fastest vehicle they had. He lowered the binoculars and sighed. It was a stinking, lousy, lonely job. He had been working in the Chronoguard for almost 40 years standard Earth time. In logged work time, he was 209. In his own personal physiological time, he was barely 28. His children were older than him, and his wife was in a nursing home. He had thought the higher rates of pay would compensate him for any problems, but they didn't. As the green saloon fell quickly away behind us, Bowden again looked back and saw the sun rising faster and higher. A helicopter arrived in a flash with the distinctive CG motif of the Chronoguard. Ahead of us now there was only the motorcyclist, who seemed to be perilously close to the dark, swirling hole. He wore red leathers and was driving a top-of-the-range Triumph motorcycle, ironically enough about the only bike capable of escape from the vortex, if he had known what the problem was. We had taken another 6 minutes to catch up with him, and as we approached, a roaring sound started to rise above the wind noise, the sort of scream a typhoon might make as it passed over the top of you. We were still about 12 feet behind, and finding it difficult to keep up. The speedometer needle on the Porsche touched 90 as we roared along together. I blew my horn, but the screaming drowned it out.
"Get ready!"
I shouted to Bowden as the wind whipped our hair and the air tugged at our clothes. I flashed my lights at the bike again, and at last he saw us. He turned around and waved, mistook our intent for a desire to initiate a race, kicked down a gear and accelerated away. The vortex caught him in an instant, and he seemed to stretch out and around and inside out as he flowed rapidly into the instability. Within what appeared to be a second, he had gone. As soon as I thought we could get no closer, I stamped on the brakes and yelled, "Now!" Smoke poured off the tyres as we careened across the tarmac. Bowden threw the basketball, which seemed to swell in size with the hole, the ball flattening to a disc and the hole stretching out to a line. We saw the basketball hit the hole, bounce once, and let us through. I glanced at the watch as we tipped through into the abyss, the basketball shutting out the last glimpse of the world we had left behind as we dropped through to elsewhere. Up until the point we passed the event, 12 minutes and 41 seconds had elapsed. Outside, it had been closer to 7 hours.
"Motorcycle's gone," remarked Colonel Rutter.
His second-in-command grunted in reply. He didn't approve of non-chronos attempting his work. They had managed to maintain the job's mysticism for over 5 decades with the wages to suit. Have-a-go heroes could only serve to weaken people's undying trust in what they did. It wasn't a difficult job, it just took a long time. He had mended a similar rent in space-time that had opened up in Weybridge's municipal park just between the floral clock and the bandstand. The job itself had taken 10 minutes. He had simply walked in and stuck a tennis ball across the hole, while outside 7 months flashed by. 7 months on double pay plus privileges, thank you very much. The Chronoguard operatives set up a large clock facing inwards, so any operatives within the field's influence would know what was happening. A similar clock on the back of the helicopter gave the officers outside a good idea of how slow time was running within. After the motorcycle disappeared, they waited another 30 minutes to see what would happen. They watched Bowden slowly rise and throw what appeared to be a basketball.
"Too late,"
murmured Rutter, having seen this sort of thing before. He ordered his men into action, and they were just starting to crank up the rotors of the helicopter when the darkness around the hole evaporated. The night slid back, and a clear road confronted them. They could see the people in the green saloon get out and look around in amazement at the sudden day. 100 yards farther on, the basketball had neatly blocked the tear and now stood trembling slightly in mid-air as the vortex behind the rip sucked at the ball. Within a minute, the tear healed and the basketball dropped harmlessly to the asphalt, bouncing a few times before rolling to the side of the road. The sky was clear, and there was no evidence that time wasn't the same as it had always been. But of the Datsun, the motorcyclist and the brightly painted sports car, there was no trace at all. My car slid on and on. The motorway had been replaced by a swirling mass of light and colour that had no meaning to either of us. Occasionally a coherent image would emerge from the murk, and on several occasions we thought we'd arrive back in a stable time, but were soon whisked back into the vortex, the typhoon raging in our ears. The first occasion was on a road somewhere in the home counties. It looked like winter, and ahead of us, a lime-green Austin Allegro estate pulled out from a slip road. I swerved and drove past at great speed, sounding my horn angrily. That image collapsed abruptly and fragmented itself into the dirty hold of a ship. The car was wedged between two packing cases, the closest of which was bound for Shanghai. The howl of the vortex had diminished, but we could hear a new roar, the roar of a storm at sea. The ship wallowed, and Bowden and I looked at one another, unsure as to whether this was the end of the journey or not. The roaring sound grew as the dank hold folded back into itself and vanished, only to be replaced by a white hospital ward. The tempest subsided, the car's engine ticking over happily. In the only occupied bed, there was a drowsy and confused woman with her arm in a sling. I knew what I had to say.
"Thursday!"
I shouted excitedly. The woman in the bed frowned. She looked across at Bowden, who waved back cheerily.
"He didn't die,"
I continued, saying now what I knew to be the truth. I could hear the tempest starting to howl again. It wouldn't be long before we were taken away.
"The car crash was a blind. Men like Acheron don't die that easily. Take the Literatech job in Swindon."
The woman in the bed just had time to repeat my last word before the ceiling and floor opened up and we plummeted back into the maelstrom. After a dazzling display of colourful noise and loud light, the vortex slid back to be replaced by the parking lot of a motorway services somewhere. The tempest slowed and stopped.
"Is this it?" asked Bowden.
"I don't know." It was night, and the street lamps cast an orange glow over the parking lot, the roadway shiny from recent rain. A car pulled in next to us. It was a large Pontiac containing a family. The wife was berating her husband for falling asleep at the wheel, and the children were crying. It looked like it had been a near miss.
"Excuse me,"
I yelled. The man wound down his window.
"Yes?"
"What's the date?"
"Date?"
"It's 18th July,"
replied the man's wife, shooting him and me an annoyed glance. I thanked her and turned back to Bowden.
"We're 3 weeks in the past?"
he queried.
"Or 56 weeks into the future."
"Or 108.
I'm going to find out where we are."
I turned off the ignition and got out. Bowden joined me as we walked towards the cafeteria. Beyond the building, we could see the motorway, and beyond that, the connecting bridge to the services on the opposite carriageway. Several tow trucks drove past us with empty cars hitched to the back of them.
"Something's not right." "I agree," replied Bowden. "But what?"
Suddenly, the doors to the cafeteria burst open, and a woman pushed her way out. She was carrying a gun and pushing a man in front of her, who stumbled as they hurried out. Bowden pulled me behind a parked van. We peered cautiously out and saw that the woman had unwelcome company. Several men had appeared seemingly from nowhere, and all of them were armed.
"What the?"
I whispered, suddenly realizing what was happening.
"That's me!"
And so it was. I looked slightly older, but it was definitely me. Bowden had noticed too.
"I'm not sure I like what you've done with your hair."
"You prefer it long?"
"Of course."
We watched as one of the three men told the other me to drop her gun. "I, me, she," said something we couldn't hear, and then put her gun down, releasing her hold on the man, who was then grabbed roughly by one of the other men.
"What's going on?"
I asked, thoroughly confused.
"We've got to go," replied Bowden.
"And leave me like this?"
"Look."
He pointed at the car. It was shaking slightly as a localized gust of wind seemed to batter it.
"I can't leave her, me, in this predicament."
But Bowden was pulling me towards the car, which was rocking more violently and starting to fade.
"Wait!"
I struggled free, pulled out my automatic, and hid it behind one of the wheels of the nearest car, then ran after Bowden and leaped into the back of the speedster. I was just in time. There was a bright flash and a peal of thunder, and then silence. I opened an eye. It was daylight. I looked at Bowden, who had made it into the driver's seat. The motorway services car park had vanished, and in its place was a quiet country lane. The journey was over.
You all right?